Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around for a breakdown of the day's top stories in the Chicago area at the end of this episode. But first, let's rewind the clock back to October, shall we? That's when, on a quiet Sunday afternoon, an Albany Park residential street turned chaotic. It happened after federal immigration agents abducted and detained a man without a warrant during Operation Midway Blitz. Now, neighbors frantically rushed outside. They pulled out their phones, shouted at the agents, and tried to stop the arrest. But then came the tear gas.
This is fascism in America, people! This is fascism in America!
Police!
We're being gassed in America by secret police!
After U.S. District Judge Sarah Ellis ordered body cam footage from Midway Blitz be released, one filmmaker decided to use it. He paired it with cell phone video that was captured by the residents to make a new documentary short. So in this episode of the pod, we'll learn more about the film and discuss what the footage says about power, resistance, and accountability. At the table, Bill Morrison, director of Sawyer Avenue Sunday Afternoon, and Maria Inez Zamudio, who's a producer on the film and an investigative journalist with the Invisible Institute. Now, in the height of Operation Midway Blitz, we'll recall videos of detentions and altercations with Border Patrol agents. They were flying all around social media. So I started by asking Maria Inez why it was important to the team to preserve and turn that footage into a documentary. Here she is.
I think it's twofold, right? For the first time, we see the Border Patrol coming in to work in cities like Chicago. Typically, the Border Patrol work within 100 miles of the border. Now, that changed under the Trump administration this time. So last year, the paramilitary law enforcement agency was deployed to work along just inside the country. And so we were really interested in looking at how the agency with this troubled history, and I can get into that a little later, might interact with people in Chicago, right? And so we got to see what happened in neighborhoods in Chicago and in Minneapolis, right? We saw agents shot and killed Americans. We saw agents use tear gas. So thanks to this body-worn camera, the use of force incident reports, cell phone footage, we were able to reconstruct this October 12 enforcement action that turned violent.
Yeah.
And we wanted to really explore what that meant.
Bill, why did you want to make this film?
Well, I had made a film called Incident that explored the police shooting of Harith Augustus. And that came out in 2023. And again, that was working in collaboration with reporting that the Invisible Institute had done. And Jamie Calden was the producer on that. And Jamie and I, after Incident, we began talking about ways in which we could use body-worn camera and police camera footage to explore this new invasion by federal agents in Chicago. So when Judge Ellis released this footage in late November, Jamie sent me a link and I began downloading all the videos. I believe there were something like 111 that were available at that time. There's many more by now. And I started going through each one of them one by one. And this was the incident that really stood out to me for a number of reasons, formally, but also politically. And
well, tell me more about that. Tell me, what was it about that particular day in Albany Park that stayed with you?
Yeah, well, I mean, just, you know, starting to scroll through it. First of all, there was a very intense interaction between the people on the street and the cameras. You know, sometimes these incidents are recorded. There's, you see tear gas or smoke on the horizon, and there's a crowd off in the distance. But this was incredible interaction between these different cameras and the citizens on the street, and they were dressed in a very, I thought, Chicago appropriate way. There was a Bears jersey and a Cubs jersey, and someone wearing a Halloween costume. There was a woman in a bathrobe. So there was identifiable characters who were coming out, and this started to appear to me to be very cinematic.
Yes,
it also had the footage of the taken from the body-worn camera of the arresting agent, tackling this person on the street, and that's where the audio begins.
Right.
And that was incredibly dramatic. And then there was, and we can get into this later, but there was an extended sequence in which the detained person started questioning the agents who were arresting him about why they were doing this.
Right. Well, I want to give listeners a taste of what you just described, right? So when you watch this documentary, the viewer sees how quickly things just spiral out of control, because it goes from being literally this beautiful October afternoon to someone being detained and neighbors resisting. Let's listen to a bit of it.
You have to put your faces.
You can't take people away without ID.
What are you doing right now, man?
You can't take people away.
Hey, QRF, they're blocking us.
We can move QRF to Sawyer and Sunnyside. We got some individuals blocking us here on the road.
What gang are you with?
Are you working for the government? Which government?
I think you're a gang member, man.
Yeah, they won't give us their names.
Yes, I need an ID. You can't take people away without an ID. I'm in my robe in the street.
Yeah, I know. Hey, right, how are you?
Maria Inez, you talked with some of those residents of that block. Tell me how they're reflecting on that moment and what they told you it was like to come together in that way and resist this detainment.
It was spontaneous. It was, I want to zoom out and like really add context about how we got here. And one of the things that happened last September is that the Supreme Court ruled that it was constitutional for federal agents to carry out Trump's mass deportation plans by questioning people and just questioning them on the status about their status based on four factors: their race or ethnicity, whether they're Spanish speakers or have an accent, and specific locations or where they might be, right? Like a Home Depot parking lot, and the type of work that they do, right? So we have this like thing that lower courts had deemed unconstitutional before, and now you have this agency that has never worked in a city context, right? They usually work along the border. And we saw them kind of coming in. They were wearing masks. And so the immediate response from neighbors, because this is Albany Park, a very diverse neighborhood, folks know each other. And so there's this immediate like wanting to go and document and wanting to ask questions. We were able to identify the woman that came outside barefoot in her bathrobe.
In the robe, yeah.
And she wanted to know, like, why are you taking my neighbor? Who are you? I think there's like a very like instinctual thing that happens when you see someone in a mask detaining someone else or chasing someone
and
else.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Maria Inez, but does she not get hit by the vehicle that they're driving?
In the video, she states that she was ran over by the vehicle that one of the agents was driving. Mm. In the incident reports, that's not mentioned and not made clear. So there's obviously like questioning around that.
Interesting.
But she does talk about it. And to Bill's point, the conversations that were happening, and this is why I really would love for folks to watch this, there's a really interesting conversation that happens between the detained immigrant and the agents.
Yes.
Asking questions about, like, why are you doing this work? But then later, when the detained immigrant is seeing the commotion outside and he's seeing these neighbors coming in and really kind of wanting to stop his detainment.
Mm-hmm.
And then this woman says, hey, you ran over my foot. He actually confronts them. Mm-hmm. And ask, like, why would you do this? Would you do this if you're a civilian?
I am so glad you brought up that part, because that, to me, was the most powerful moment in this documentary. And you play it pretty early in the doc, where we get to see inside the vehicle after this man is detained. He's in the back seat. Normally, if you recall, all the footage you were seeing on Instagram and TikTok, it's outside, right? It's what's happening on the street. It's people getting each other's faces. We get to see the back seat of the car, where he slows things down and he says, you know, do you know how many innocent people you're taking? He says all this in Spanish to the agent. Do you know how many people are out there getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning just to work in order to have a better future? And no response from the federal agent. He says, we don't have the same opportunities you have. So, Bill, tell me more about what that moment means to you.
Yeah, I mean, that was, like you say, it's amazing to not only be inside that car, but also to have someone so composed, having just been body slammed to the ground and handcuffed. And, you know, he's asking, what do I do with my keys? Meaning, what do I do with the rest of my life? You know, and now he's taken into this car. And the fact that he's calm enough and composed enough to ask these guys in a really eloquent way, why are you doing this? I know there's nothing you can do about it right now, but you have to think, you know, what is your role in this is basically what he's asking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at first when I saw the footage, I understood just visually that this was happening, though I couldn't make out the Spanish. My Spanish isn't good enough. But I showed it in a room, and a woman said, do you understand what they're saying there? And I was like, well, some of it. And she was like, this is really compelling. And so with that, I understood that we had a really important piece of footage, and that we could really build out the film around that. It does happen early, because it happens early in the chronology of the event. But I agree that it's really remarkable footage.
So, you know, for most of the doc, we see this four-way split screen of the same footage from four different angles. Some of it really jarring for me as I was watching it. I felt like I was being re-traumatized a bit, you know, watching what was unfolding in real life several months ago. I want to play a bit here where, you know, it's in the midst of the chaos. The federal agents deploy tear gas, and then they call CPD for help.
911, I'm off right away.
Hi, this is Customs and Border Protection. We're on Sawyer and Wilson Avenue. A crowd is blocking us in. We need to get out. We're trying to get out of here. We need CPD to get here and move this crowd.
They don't want to clear. We're going to pass. Let's go.
There's a crowd that's preventing us from getting out of the street.
Is there something going on out there? Like an event or something?
There's a crowd.
All right, I'll send the police to you.
So, Maria Inez, there have been ongoing calls from residents and some aldermen to investigate the role that Chicago police are playing in assisting immigration enforcement efforts. What did you take away from this footage of that 911 call?
I think it really showcases how out of their element these agents are.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they're used to operating along the U.S.-Mexico border, within 100 miles of that border. Now they're free to roam around. And, you know, during Operation Midway Blitz, under Gregory Volvino's command, agents regularly violated the use of force limits that Judge Ellis imposed. And, you know, along with the videos, we were also able to review incident reports, use of force incident reports. So through those, mm-hmm. we were actually doing the thing that neighbors wanted, right? Which is, who are you? Who do you work for? What is your name, right? Something that I think Chicagoans are really used to when it comes to dealing with Chicago police officers, for example, that may not be, they may be using force on them. So a lot of that to me was like important to showcase.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's, I think that you can see that the Trump administration really wanting to work with law enforcement agents through the 287G program, right? Which is like a force multiplier. The administration says that, right?
Yeah.
If you can have law enforcement agents doing immigration work, and by the way, I have to make this clear, crossing the border without legal documents is a civil offense. So now having these agents do that work is one of the things that is going to speed up this mass deportation
right.
plan. But in Chicago, there's very strict guidelines because of the welcoming ordinance, right? And I think that the Chicago Police Department has been in this space of like not really knowing what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were actually able to find other 911 calls that were made around the same time by neighbors as well. And the police actually showed up after the agents left. But in other instances, in other confrontations in the South Side, for example, the police did show up. And so they were doing crowd control, right? So there's this like small distinction between like, are they doing law enforcement or are they actually detaining immigrants?
I just remember creating a lot of confusion back then.
Yes. And I think that was one of the questions also around whether or not police officers should be investigated by COPA, for example, for violating the Welcoming Ordinance Act. So I think that's still like a point of contention. And I think Illinois is like particularly in a really interesting space because during the first Trump administration, there was all these layers of laws that were created to protect immigrants who live in the state. And so I think that we're going to continue seeing that play out, that struggle of like, what exactly can CPD do to assist immigration agents, essentially?
Well, last word to you, Bill, and tell us how folks can watch this film.
So this film will be released by The New Yorker through their YouTube channel, which is not beyond a paywall.
Okay.
This week, perhaps today, we are waiting for DHS to sign off on it, actually, or at least to respond to it before we release the film to the public. But we're expecting it to come out very shortly.
Bill Morrison is director of Sawyer Avenue Sunday Afternoon, and Maria Ines Zamudio is a producer on that film, also with the Invisible Institute. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Turn now to the top Chicago area news stories of the day with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, WBEZ reporter Summer Van Venten, and Mohammed Samra, a reporter with the Chicago Sun-Times. Some positive news to start. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul is working to find consumers some savings on their gas bill. Claire kicked things off with that update.
So I think we all know that the price of gas in our homes in Illinois has gone up considerably in recent months. I think in 2 years, mine has doubled.
Yes.
And to curb the problem really before it gets worse, Raoul is starting to push back. Sun-Times reporting that People's Gas, as we know, has been proposing this $200 million rate hike. They keep saying that it's needed to cover inflation, also to continue their pipe retirement program. Consumer advocates are saying that the company has really doubled down on its replacement-only approach, so not repairs necessarily. And there are viable alternatives that exist that could be saving money, but they're just not looking in the right places. But Raoul's office also says that People's Gas potentially double-counted some of these cost estimates for that program and is asking for funds without really stating what their goals are clearly. So it could be some hidden savings, and we'll see what happens.
Wow, that would be excellent.
Welcome. That would
be
welcome.
Yes, absolutely. Now, an aide to Chicago Congressman Danny Davis in other news. They're in a bit of hot water. This is over pandemic relief money. What should we know here?
Yeah, this is dating back to May 2020, but news today nonetheless. This is an aide to longtime Chicago Congressman Danny Davis is being charged with fraud. Gerard Moorer is accused of filing a fraudulent application with the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. Tribune reporting that Moorer claimed he was out of work, you know, like many people were back in 2020, but it was while he was employed by the federal government as Davis's aide. So that
can't
Can't quite make that one work, but he continued to do it for 16 months, was claiming unemployment while he was employed. So far, Moorer is accused of defrauding that program out of $32,000. And his arraignment is scheduled for next week.
And you know what, Claire, this all sounds very familiar because I'm like, who didn't at this point? Who didn't abuse pandemic relief programs? We've heard so many stories.
All those boxes of masks and PPE, things that went missing. I didn't defraud anybody.
No, I didn't. Yeah, we didn't.
That's two.
These two didn't either. They're
Some are shaking their head.
No. Mohammed, over to you. Police reform advocate and social worker Anjanette Young. She's a step closer to a seat on Chicago's Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability. That's the city's Civilian Police Oversight Committee. I want to play a little bit of what she had to say. She was on In the Loop last week and talked about what motivated her to serve.
as a social worker, I've always been one who wanted to advocate for care of individual families and children. And so it was important to me as we look at policy change and how the police interact with communities, we want to protect our children.
So, Mohammed, tell us the latest on the process of Young joining what we know as the CCPSA.
Yeah, so the Chicago City Council's Police and Fire Committee voted near unanimously on Wednesday to confirm Young as one of seven commissioners on the CCPSA.
Oh, wow.
And if she wins full council backing, she would assume that role after the current commissioner's term expires in June.
Yeah, well, so it's looking good for her. Yeah, as we expected, right? She went through quite the ordeal, has quite the firsthand account to lend to this community commission.
And Mayor Johnson has, I think, long been sort of looking for the right way to sort of give her her due diligence. And this seems like it's going to be the way that works out best.
So if she does officially get confirmed for the position, Mohammed, I mean, what sway would she have over police policy?
So she would have sway over who leads CPD, and she would also have the ability to recommend a superintendent's hiring or firing. And she would also be responsible for helping draft and review policies for the police department, mm-hmm. as well as the policies of two other agencies involved with police oversight.
I see. In other news, visitation services for slain Chicago police officer John Bartholomew, they're happening today, right? What should we know?
So visitation will be at St. Andrew's Greek Orthodox Church from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. today. And Friday service will also be at the church beginning at 10 a.m. There are going to be some road closures. So Lakeshore Drive, Sheridan Road, Bryn Mawr Ave will all be shut down from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. this evening today. And then again from 9 in the morning tomorrow to 3 in the afternoon for the services.
Yeah, and of course, this dates back to the horrific incident at Swedish Hospital. We know that, John Bartholomew unfortunately died in the incident on the job. And there was another officer who was injured in that shooting as well. Do we know any updates on him?
So the latest, based on Fran Spielman's reporting, was that the wounded officer was showing signs of improvement per the police union.
Right.
But we haven't heard anything further than that.
Mm. Claire, a lot of people expected to pay respects, as Mohammed just pointed out. So it's probably going to be a little bit of a hiccup for traffic.
Yeah, I mean, if you're anywhere near the 5600 block, this is on North Sheridan Road, which is where the church is in Edgewater. Expect to see a lot of squad cars. Caravans, too, is what Mohammed's referring to, are probably going to be what shuts down the drive, just sort of the initial transporting of family members and whatnot. So that will likely be toward the beginning of the afternoon. But if you're in Edgewater, yeah, there's going to be a large police presence, lots of flashing red and blue lights.
Summer, there's a wreath laying on the south side this weekend. It's to honor Civil War soldiers. What should we know about that?
Mm-hmm. So the Bronzeville Historical Society, along with the Sons of Union Soldiers and the Daughters of Union Soldiers, are honoring those who served in the Civil War. There's a call out for Black Chicagoans, seeing if their family members have served in the Civil War and if they could, you know, share stories, names, photos. This is an ongoing project to congregate and gather all of these details. And tomorrow they're actually hosting a wreath laying service, as you mentioned, at 11 a.m. at Oakwood Cemetery, and a broader exhibition showcasing all of this work later on in July.
Mm-hmm. Mohammed, back to you. Brookfield Zoo, that strike is over. So have they reached a deal?
Yeah, so they've reached a tentative agreement, so it'll be for 4 years. And they reached it on the third day of the strike, so it seemed like both sides went to the table and got a little bit of what they wanted.
So back up for a little bit and just remind us what the sticking points were in this.
So when I spoke to union employees on Monday morning outside of Brookfield Zoo, their sticking points, the one thing that really stood out to them was staffing. They were really concerned about being understaffed.
Oh, okay.
But they also talked a little bit about health care and rising wages for the rising cost of living expenses. And so within the tentative agreement, there is a 20% wage increase over the course of the contract. There's also enhancements to staffing, as well as three positions that are already posted for hiring, and also enhanced health care contributions from the zoo.
Oh, wow. So sounds like the union got what they wanted.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. It sounds like they got what they wanted.
Very good. Now, yesterday, Claire, we talked about the piping plovers. Remember
my
that?
My friends.
Yes. Today, is this right? There's a new baby?
It's a baby eaglet. Bird? It is an eaglet. It is actually the first baby eagle born in Chicago in more than a century.
Oh, wow.
So we've seen them across the Chicago area. Park District is saying there are records of eagles nesting, also attempts to rear a chick. But those attempts up until last month were unsuccessful. So our new eaglet was documented at Park 597 on the city's far southeast side. Birders had been watching this nest and any nesting activity since February. It sounds like the really dedicated birders with their binoculars all bundled up. Mm-hmm. They spotted the chick, though, meaning that it hatched on April 28th. Park District is asking for now, if you're curious, just avoid, you know, getting very close to the nest, being respectful. And yes, to answer your question that I know you're going to ask, the Park District is going to sponsor and name the eaglet contest.
Yes, that was the next question.
Yes. And we've seen, you know, some of these piping plovers on the north side being named for, you know, local native different kinds of plants. So we'll see if the far southeast side is something.
The piping plover names are pretty, you know, pretty
Imani, Monty, Rose. Right. So we'll see. And it sounds like they really, you know, are trying to engage the community with this and rep the southeast side, because there's a lot of marshland down there. And, you know, people do like to support the wildlife there as well.
Nice. Summer, May is National Stroke Awareness Month. And you just did some reporting finding that stroke risk is up. It's risen more than 50% over the past two decades. So tell us more about what's behind the spike.
Yeah, so it's all due to environmental factors, increased smoking, pollution, diet changes. And I feel like, you know, strokes are more common than we realize. And we hear the word stroke and it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. And so that's why this recognition is so important.
Who's most at risk of getting a stroke?
Most at risk, technically those who are over 60 years old. But what they're finding out is that young adults are starting to, they're seeing more cases of young adults experiencing strokes as well. These are 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds.
Wow.
And so it's definitely getting younger. And so everyone should be mindful and be aware.
Is there some good news at all in your reporting?
Yeah. So actually, the University of Chicago's medical team, the neurologist at UChicago, took some of us on a tour of their stroke unit facilities and showed us the launch pad and showed us the process of what happens when patients come in. And two big takeaways. One, the technology has advanced so much. In previous years, they would have to take vitals in a separate room, transfer you to the CAT scan room, get your CAT scan before even doing a procedure. Now they can do all of that in one space, cutting down time significantly. And if you know, with strokes, time is of the essence. Every minute counts. And the doctor, he mentioned that at a certain point, it would take 8 to 10 hours maybe to administer treatment and to you know, perform these cases.
Right.
Now they can happen in all of 6 minutes, which is a huge shift. And
yeah, that's great.
Yeah. The number of younger people experiencing these strokes are increasing, but with increased awareness of the signs, they're able to get to these cases much sooner.
Claire, what other stories are you following?
Well, I'm only wanting to cover this because we've been covering it so much on your show, but tickets for the Obama Presidential Center, as we were watching the clock literally tick down.
Tell me they're not sold out.
They are sold out for June, and most of July. Sun-Times reporting that the first month of tickets snapped right up by the Chicago community, probably some tourists as well, literally hours after they were made available.
Yeah, no surprises there.
But wait till winter. Calendar largely remains open in November, and that also includes, if you are an Illinois resident, Tuesdays, which will be free days for those of us who call Illinois home. So there's some ways to save, and again, might be a nice little winter hideaway. We should remind people, too, that you can still access the museum's campus for free. So not necessarily going into the museum, but you can include, you know, walk the gardens, walk the trails, see some of the sports outside, as well as check out that Chicago Public Library. I know Summer's been covering that. That's also free.
I was walking the trail last night, actually, just right around the coincidentally, I was checking out the Osaka Garden. I'm thinking of taking some photos there in the future. Prom is coming up. I'm like, oh, what's a cute Chicago backdrop for the kid?
We know you've been lurking around the Obama Presidential Center. We know that. Cardio. She's doing it for cardio.
I may be one of those people, you know, with the June tickets, but, you know, mind your business, Claire.
You'll have to keep us posted.
Shots at 9 in the morning is kind of crazy.
Summer, we've got information about who's going to be performing at this year's Millennium Park Summer Music Series. Fill us in.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, the series runs select Mondays and Thursdays and some other days as well throughout the summer from June 10th to August 15th. Typically, these concerts start around 6:30 with gates opening around 5 p.m. And seating is on a first come, first serve basis. Now, there are a range of artists who will be performing a range of genres as well. If you like classical, if you like opera, there will also be some house and DJ sets as well. So it'll be really fun and really engaging.
And when does the series start?
It's between June 10th and August 15th.
Nice. What other stories are you following, Mohammed?
So it's not a confirmed story yet, but I've been keeping in contact with Gentry Hunt, who was a gunshot victim with the St. Sabina shooting at the beginning of the year. He was on his way to a basketball tournament.
Oh, yes.
And so I had been keeping up with him, and his recovery has been nothing short of miraculous. He's been using his experience to kind of teach those he's mentoring how to use basketball as a way to combat gun violence. So just keeping the pulse on him and trying to find the right time to follow up with him and share his story.
We'll keep an eye on suntimes.com for your reporting, because I know that'd be great. And I love good news. I love good news. Love that he's on the mend. Summer, anything else on your radar that
so
we should know?
So many things. Monday, I actually covered the Chicago Met Gala, which was really awesome to see.
That's people fun.
Come. Yeah, it was super fun. People came dressed inspired by their favorite Chicago artists, and they also streamed the New York Met Gala. Bears Care, which is the philanthropic arm of the Chicago Bears, is hosting their annual charitable gala this weekend. They're raising money for the advancement of breast and ovarian cancer, which is always awesome. Chicago River Day is this Saturday, and the Friends of the Chicago River are hosting a massive river cleanup from 9 to 12, and there will be more than 90 cleanup locations along the river. So
cool.
If you're interested in helping keep that river clean,
roll up your sleeves, friends.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.